Well, I've been doing a lot of reading in church history, and I think if you read enough pages of church history, you find some strange things along the way. This was one of those strange encounters. It was a man who is known as the first of the desert fathers. And you say, why was this guy called a desert father? Well, figure it out. He lived in the desert. That's right. He didn't grow up in the desert, though. He actually moved to the desert. This man's name is Simeon the Stylite. Now, he's an interesting character. He lived in 423 AD. And the reason he's interesting is because he moved to the desert for 6 years to live on top of a pillar that he built in the Syrian desert. You say, all right, wait, back up there, Lucas. you heard me correctly. This guy, Simeon the Stylite, went out to the Syrian desert. He built this big pillar. He got up on top of the pillar, and then he lived there for 6 years in the desert. Now, some of us are wondering, was this guy out of his mind? And what in the world was he doing there? Well, he received a great many visitors along the path. I mean, they would come out to see this dude that's sitting perched up on top of a pillar, and they would ask him, Simeon, what are you doing on top of that post? He would explain that he wanted to be a Christian who communed with God in solitude. So would you people quit coming out here? I want to commune with God in solitude, he said, and I want to be free from worldly distractions. And so his answer to that was to go live on a pole in the middle of the desert. Now, you read this story, you say, this is a strange story, Lucas, and what's the point? Well, the point is, I think we should wrestle with what he was doing there and ask the question that many people wanted to ask, and that is that what it means to live a spiritual life? I mean, he went out to the desert, lived on top of a pole because he felt like the further you get from the earth, the closer you get to heaven. So, I mean, maybe we need to get in elevators and hit the 10th floor because then we're going to be more spiritual. Or he thought, the further you get away from cities and civilizations, the more solitude you can have with God. So maybe we should all just go out to the Great Salt Flats and wander around because that's what it really means to be spiritual. I mean, wrestle with this question this morning. What does it mean to be spiritual? If you were to ask that question out on this campus, you'd get a great variety of answers, wouldn't you? What does it mean to be spiritual? In our study of Galatians, specifically Galatians chapter 5, Paul has been seeking to answer that very question. What does it mean to be spiritual? What are the evidences of someone who has the Spirit of God inside of them? And so when he unfolds that, you get to the end of Galatians chapter 5, he says, listen, you can see these things kind of clearly. He says, self-evident are the manifestations of the flesh. And in verse number 19, he begins to unfold what it means to be fleshly. But then you get to verse number 21, 22, right in there, you're going to start seeing, well, what does it mean to be spiritual? And he begins this way. The fruit of the Spirit, or literally, the demonstration that the Spirit of God is abiding in you and working out of you. What does it mean to be spiritual? The fruit of the Spirit is this: love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, self-control. That's what it means to be spiritual. Not going and living in the desert on the top of some post, but rather displaying the fruit of a Spirit-filled life. That's what it means to be spiritual. Now, the challenge when we get to the end of chapter 5 is this. Okay, yeah, love, joy, peace. I mean, didn't the 60s do that? I mean, there were these vans that would roll across the United States with peace symbol. I mean, wait. What does it mean, love, joy, peace? I mean, what does that look like? What is long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance, self-control? What does all that look like? Like, Paul, stop. I like those words. I mean, those are really deep words. But how does it work out in life? I mean, Paul, could you give us a few case studies? Paul, could you help us see what it looks like to live a spiritual life? And so after he unfolds these fruits of the Spirit, he's actually going to do exactly what I just said. He's going to start saying, well, listen, a spiritual life, I mean, one that's operating by the Spirit, you're walking by the Spirit, you're being led by the Spirit, you're filled with the Spirit, one that looks like that, it produces fruit which actually looks like this in real life. And then he gives some case studies. So that's what we're going to do this morning. I just want to answer this question. So what should we expect to see in the life of someone who is walking in the Spirit? I mean, what should we see from their lives? And I think that's what Paul answers in our text this morning. And the first thing I think we'll see is this. If you are truly walking in the Spirit, then you are going to bury the foolish pursuits of vain glory. I mean, literally, if the Spirit is the one who's leading you, if the Spirit's voice is the one you're listening to, then you're going to take all of these ambitions for empty glory, for personal success, you're going to take all those and you're going to get rid of them. You're going to bury them. You're going to bury these pursuits of vain glory. And I want you to see that in the text. Notice verse number 25. It starts out with a conditional phrase, and it's important that we leave it that way because he wants you to wrestle with the condition here. He says, if we live by the Spirit, let us also keep in step with the Spirit. Now that word if is a tiny word with great implications. He wants you to ask yourself, do you really live by the Spirit? And stop for a second and ask yourself, do you live by the Spirit? Does the Spirit live in you? Are you inclining your ear to the Spirit? Are you a true Christian? He says, if you are, then this is what we should expect from your life. So if you live by the Spirit, then literally you should live out the Spirit. He's going to say, then you should keep in step with the Spirit. It should be evident by your life that you truly have the Spirit of God living in you. Now this phrase, notice verse 25, he says, then keep in step with the Spirit. What do you think of when you think of keeping in step? I mean, I'm thinking of, there's weddings, right? I mean, this is the, 'tis the season for the weddings. It's June. How many of you got married in, it's May. How many of you got married in May? I have my anniversary on my mind. It's the 10th anniversary, June 10th. 15th anniversary, June. Oh, I'm mixing up my, oh, I'm in trouble. Anyone want to come over for lunch? It's my 15th anniversary, June 10th. But we're in May, May, June. How many of you were married in May or June? Okay. So you think keeping in step. All of a sudden, you're thinking of these groomsmen and bridesmaids. And what are they doing? They're trying to keep in step as they walk down the aisle, right? Stay in step. You don't want some groomsman like rushing down and the bridesmaid's left behind there. She's like, wait up, wait. I mean, that looks goofy. You have to keep in step. Or some of you are thinking, when you think keep in step, you're thinking of military, right? You're thinking of soldiers marching. There's a few of us military members in here this morning. I mean, do you remember, you military members, do you remember when you first learned to march? And I'm thinking back to officer training school at Maxwell Air Force Base. I mean, I had no idea about anything military. I walk onto this thing and I start getting yelled at immediately. And they were going to teach us how to march. And so over a course of months, we're taught all this drill and how to do all these things, right? How to lead marching and all this. But it came down to the graduation day. And on graduation day, we had to do a parade in front of the commandant and all the ranking officers at Maxwell Air Force Base. And I can remember, I mean, there's hundreds of us. And we have to march in step on this parade ground. And we have to do it right in front. I mean, we would pass right in front of the commandant and all these ranking officers. And they would have us face, like all of a sudden, psh, we all had to turn this way as we march by. All this stuff. And I can remember being so nervous. You know, I'm thinking like left, 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 right. I mean, I'm like rehearsing. I didn't want to be the one dude, you know, that guy. I didn't want to be that guy who they're like looking at all these hundreds of Air Force airmen. And they're all in step except for that one guy. He's like trying to catch up. You know, you do this little stutter step to try to get back on. I mean, I didn't want to be that guy. I wanted to make sure that I stayed in sync, stayed in step. What is Paul saying here? He says, listen, if the Spirit of God lives in you, if you are living in the Spirit, then you're in step with him. You're in sync with him. You're walking that out
in your daily life. And so verse 25, if we live by the Spirit, let us keep in step with the Spirit. Oh, that sounds great, Paul, but what does that look like? And this is where he starts getting down to details. Okay. You want to know what it looks like to walk in step with the Spirit? It means you have to get rid of all of your selfish ambition and vainglory. I mean, you are naturally programmed. Your default setting is to seek glory for yourself. You want to pursue numero uno. It's all about me. That's kind of how we're programmed in life. He says, if you're walking in the Spirit, then you have to bury those pursuits of vainglory. That's verse 26. He says, listen, let us not become conceited. The word conceit means let us not pursue vainglory, conceit, me, self. Let us not become conceited, provoking one another, envying one another. So what Paul is saying here is we need to put away or get rid of or bury our conceit, our self-centeredness, if in fact we're going to walk in step with the Spirit. So how do we bury conceit or self-centeredness or vainglory? How do we do that? Well, he says, look, stop provoking one another. Stop envying one another. Do you realize that conceit can come in two forms? It can come in the form of a superiority complex or what? Or an inferiority complex. Do you know that both of those at the very center of gravity, of whether you think you're superior or whether you think you're inferior, do you know what's at the center of gravity? Self. You. You're conceited. You're stuck on self. And so he says here, so stop it, bury it, cast it away. Stop provoking one another with your superiority complex, with this idea that you always have a competitive edge towards someone, with this stance that you're better than them. You're always looking down on their weakness. You aggravate or stir them up. Have you ever seen kids do this? You get the strong kid, he comes over and starts poking at the weak kid. Poking at him, irritating him. Any of you have kids? You just watch this happen. Nagging at him, pestering him. They're stirring him up. They're provoking him. And the reason they feel like they can do that is because what's that little kid going to do? I mean, what's he really going to do, right? So I can poke, 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 poke. Do what I want. Anger them. Stir them up. Because I'm bigger. I'm better. I'm superior. I can do that. Do you know that even within the community of believers, there are people that look down their nose at other people. They feel like they can stir them up, wrangle them up. Irritate them, frustrate them, because they have the superiority complex. Oh, well. No, he says, stop. Put off the provoking one another, your superiority complex. Put off your inferiority complex, your envying of one another. Envy means you want something that rightfully belongs to someone else, or you want that other person not to have that thing. If you envy people, it means you have a stance of inferiority. You have something in you that feels like you want what they have and you don't have it. And at the center of that, again, is you. So Paul says, listen, if you're going to walk in step with the Spirit, then bury your conceit. Bury this pursuit of self-glory. Bury your superiority and inferiority complexes. Both of them have self at the center. Now, you may be a mixture of the two. I mean, maybe in some circumstances you feel superior, and maybe in other circumstances you feel inferior. But most of us tend toward one or the other. I mean, actually, I guess I could just say it like this. I mean, I'll just be blunt, and I don't mean to hurt your feelings, but I'm just going to tell you, all of us in here struggle with conceit. It means self. All of us struggle. And all of us probably have a bent one way or another. I mean, all of us probably bend towards like a superiority thing. We look down our nose. Or an inferiority thing. We're always in fear of what people think. But at the center of it is us. Let me ask you a few questions, and maybe it will help assess where you are. Do you have a superiority complex or an inferiority complex? So here's some questions. Do you have a tendency to blow up or do you have a tendency to clam up? Do you see the difference? Superiority, what are they going to probably do? They don't care. Inferiority? Okay, here's another question. Do you tend to pick arguments with people or do you tend to avoid confrontation? Do you see that? Superiority, inferiority, but self is at the center. Here's a third one. Do you tend to critically look down on individuals or groups of people? Or do you get embarrassed and intimidated by certain types of people? Do you see the difference? Superiority, inferiority complex. When you're criticized, so think back to the last time you were criticized. when you're criticized, do you get angry? Do you get judgmental? Do you attack back? Or when you're criticized, do you get discouraged and defensive? Inferiority, superiority complex. Okay, think about the last one here. Do you often think, I'd never do that? Stupid, weak people. I'd never do that. Incompetent. I'd never do that. Or do you think to yourself, I could never accomplish that. I'll never amount to that. Do you see how both of these sides still have self at the center? And we probably tend towards one or the other. So which one are you? Because God says this to you this morning, regardless of which side you're on, if you're going to walk in step with the Spirit, then bury your conceit. Stop provoking and stop envying one another. That's our first movement in this passage. Paul says, if you live by the Spirit, keep in step with the Spirit, and that means bury these pursuits of vain glory. But then beyond that, I mean, if we could just get past self, if we could bury self, then all of a sudden our eyes are open to whom? Yeah, I mean, here we got, we can see Jesus and the fact that he's a burden bearer, and we can see people who are hurting and find we need to bear theirs too, right? I mean, all of a sudden we're not looking here. We're not looking in the mirror itself. We're actually able to see beyond that. And that's what Paul says here. He says, if you're going to walk in the Spirit, then bury your pursuits of vainglory and start bearing the weights that God intends for you to bear. What are those weights? And I think he unfolds three of them here for us. I mean, there's weights that you need to bear. And here's the first one. Bear underneath the weight of the fallen. I mean, if you can get past yourself, your superiority complex or your inferiority complex, if you can get past yourself, then all of a sudden you're going to be able to start bearing the weights of the fallen. What does it look like in verse 1? Brothers, if anyone is caught in any transgression, Galatians 6:1, you who are spiritual should restore him in a spirit of gentleness. Keep watch on yourself, lest you too be tempted. So if you can bury this pursuit of vainglory, then all of a sudden you can start bearing the weight of the fallen. I mean, this verse is describing a person here. They're tripped up. They've fallen in their lives. I want you to think about your own spiritual walk this past week. Did you trip? Did you stumble? Did you fall? I mean, this passage here is talking about someone. So here we are, and we're in a community of believers, and all of a sudden we look out and we see someone who's caught or snared or tripped up in a transgression. I'll tell you, sometimes this happens, and what you start getting is a crowd of gawkers instead of a crowd of helpers. You know what I'm talking about. It's on I-15 nearly every day. There's someone with an accident, and then we all drive by and look at them. A crowd of gawkers instead of helpers. And he says, stop, get past yourself and start bearing the burdens of other people. You look out and you see someone who's struggling. You see someone who's tripped and someone who's fallen. Then you need to help bear the burden of the fallen. And that's what he's calling us to here. Don't look down at them. Don't be so insecure that you don't know if you can talk to them. Go help bear their burdens. Now, when I think about getting tripped up or falling, the idea in the Greek word here is something that comes upon. They're caught in a transgression. It's the idea like it was a sudden attack, or it was from out of nowhere, or it came to them by surprise. And don't you feel like sin does that to you sometimes? I mean, think about it. Galatians chapter 1, verse 4, we live in a present evil world. There's an evil world. There are fiery darts from the evil one. Our flesh rages and sometimes even surprises us. This world attacks us from the outside. And so here you are, you're trying to walk through the Christian life. You're trying to walk in step with the Spirit. You're trying to listen to his voice. When all of a sudden you get attacked, there is a lion who's prowling about, seeking who he can attack and devour. And in our own Christian lives, we understand that experience. And he's saying here, you know what? You're going to look around, you're going to see Christians who get attacked. They get ambushed. They get caught in a transgression by surprise. About 10 years ago, I began running with a guy named Jason Malos. It was down in Texas, and this guy,
I shouldn't have started running with him because he was one of those ultra runners, you know, like the 50 milers, those kind of guys that make you sick. You're like, if I even walked 50 miles, my feet would just fall off me. And they run, you know, I mean, he's one of those dudes. So we started doing all this trail running. There was probably a group of 8 of us. We started doing trail running down in Texas and started running with this guy. Now, to get used to trail running, I mean, I learned some hard lessons about trail running because trails are different than roads, you know. I mean, there's like, there's rocks and there's holes. And on one particular day, I discovered there are stumps on the trail. Here I am enjoying my run, looking at God's beautiful creation all around me. I mean, I'm just, when all of a sudden I hit this little stump. I mean, it was right in the middle of the trail, never saw it. I hit this thing with my toe, and the next thing I knew, I just face planted right in the dirt. Just boom. Now, I didn't anticipate it. I didn't see it coming, but it took me by surprise. Now, at the end of the day, I could try to make excuses. Oh, it's not my fault. I mean, okay, I should have been watching. But I did get taken by surprise. And I think in our spiritual lives sometimes, we can't say, well, I'm a victim of sin. No, you did choose. It's your fault ultimately. I got that. But sometimes it feels like we get ambushed. And so you find these Christians who are struggling, and they're here they are in the midst of a transgression. And what are you supposed to do? Well, get past yourself and start bearing burdens with them. Bear under the weight of the fallen. And so I think what he does here is he calls us to some things. So if we're going to bear under the weight of people who are caught in a transgression, then it's a call to do a few things. Number one, it's a call to confrontation. You see someone caught in a transgression. Ooh, they look like they really spilled there. I don't know if I want to talk to them. No, you got to go talk to them. I don't like talking to people who have fallen down. Well, they need your help. Go talk to them. Do you realize that confrontation kind of has like a negative tone to it? Like, I don't know if I want to confront somebody. That's like mean to do. Oh, my friend, if we're trapped, we need someone to say, hey, you look trapped. Can I help you? So here you are. You see someone who's caught in a transgression. Then you who are spiritual should restore him. You say, I don't see the word confrontation. Well, how in the world did you ever get to the place of restoration if you never talked to him? You've got to talk to him. I mean, you've got to talk to them about what's going on in their life. And it seems to me if you'd grab the body of Scripture, places like Matthew chapter 18, 1 Corinthians chapter 5, Luke chapter 17, you start seeing that God actually teaches us to do that for one another. So listen, if I'm trapped, if I'm fallen in some sort of transgression, do you know what I expect from you, brother? Do you know what I expect from you, sister? That you would come and confront me. You'd come talk to me. Hey, Lucas, you seem like you're tripped up. You seem like you've fallen in this way. You know, one of the greatest things I've loved about this last year of community group is the fact that we just, you know, you live and you learn people's lives. I mean, we meet together Wednesdays. We share prayer requests with each other. Hey, I'm struggling with this. You start seeing people text each other through the week. Hey, are you doing all right with this sin struggle? Hey, I haven't seen you and I'm worried about you. You know what I mean? All of a sudden, you start seeing that community take place. And I think that's what we're supposed to do. I think it's a mark of a slumbering church when they refuse to have any measure of accountability or confrontation. That's not God's way. And so we need to awaken from that. We have to get past our paralysis with fear. Some of us are paralyzed by fear. We just don't want to talk to somebody who's struggling. Oh, my friend, God actually calls you to do that. You see this brother, they're tripped up in some sort of a transgression. Go. Talk to them. You're called to do that. Well, I don't want to be called judgmental. Friend, it would be like a parent saying, I never want to correct my kids because I don't want them to feel like I'm correcting them. I don't want them to feel like I'm judgmental. No, it's part of the relationship that we have with one another. So it's a call to confrontation here, but I think it's also a call to restoration. You who are spiritual should restore him, verse number one. Restore him. So that's the difference between judgmentalism and love. I mean, judgmentalism confronts people, but it's to put them down. It's to stick them under your thumb. It's to belittle them. That's judgmentalism. It's put yourself up by pushing them down. That's judgmentalism. Love is a confrontation that seeks to restore. You want to bring them back to a place where they're pleasing God. Now, this word in the text where it says,
And you who are spiritual should restore. The word restore there, it was used of rebuilding walls in the Bible. It was used of rebuilding walls that had come down. It was used of repairing fishing nets that were torn. It was used to refer to a joint or something that was out of joint. And you put it back in. You say, man, that sounds painful. You ever had something out of joint? I was a high school wrestler in ninth grade. I weighed 107 pounds. I was practically two-dimensional because I was about as tall as I am now. But when I turned sideways, you couldn't see me. I mean, that's what life was like in ninth grade. I weighed 107 pounds. And here I am. I remember I'm like locked up with this dude. We were scrimmaging in another school, and I'm locked up with this dude. And these other two people were scrimmaging right near us, and they got locked up. And all of a sudden, one guy fell, and he fell right on the side of my knee, just like this. And my knee just went, something like that, little pop sound, yeah. And I could not get up. I mean, it was game over. And I remember I could not move my leg. I mean, this thing is messed up. Had to get to the hospital, and this doctor grabs my leg and grabs my knee. You know what this? Yeah. I mean, he just like popped this thing back. How does that feel? And he moved it. I'm like, ah! I mean, it felt terrible and great at the same time, right? I mean, it had to go back, but man, that hurt. He says, listen, if you see someone who's caught, you need to restore them. You say, that's going to be painful. That's going to be hard. Yes, but they need to get back to that restored state, that mended condition. You need to restore this person. But you're doing it out of humility. I mean, you just have this heart. Let me just ask you, I mean, is this your heart this morning? When you see someone who's struggling, do you have a heart toward them or away from them? I don't really like struggling people. I don't like to hang out with struggling people. Or are you like inclined towards them? I want to help them. There's this old hymn that I learned as a kid. It was by Fanny Crosby. It says, rescue the perishing, care for the dying. Weep o'er the erring one, lift up the fallen. Tell them of Jesus, the mighty to save. I mean, here you're seeking to rescue those who are hurting. You're, because that's what Jesus did to us, right? I mean, he inclined himself towards us. He worked restoration in our lives. And so you who are spiritual, that's your call. Now, when he says you who are spiritual, restore. Now, some of us maybe are like, well, who are the spiritual ones? Because that must be like that elite group of restorers. Like, we call it the restoration ministry at Gospel Grace Church. No, there's no restor. I mean, we're all supposed to be restorers, right? If you have the Spirit, then you are the spiritual ones. If you're walking in the Spirit, you see someone taken, then you're the spiritual one. Then you, which are spiritual, go to them in a heart of meekness or gentleness and seek their restoration. It's a call to confrontation, to restoration, to self-examination. Look at verse number 1. Keeping watch of yourself, lest you too be tempted. What does this mean? It means we don't go up there like we've got it all together. We've never had any struggles. You know, I'm pretty much near perfect. Sorry to hear you're struggling. Sorry to hear your life is so stinky. Let me help you out, you poor person. I mean, you know, like all of a sudden you're like, that kind of has a stench of conceit. My friends, listen to me. Pride is like smoke from a campfire. You can smell it on people. So you come and you see someone taking in a fault and you're supposed, oh, I'm going to go help them out. You better do it in a spirit of gentleness and meekness or they're going to smell it on you. No, you go up to them and you understand, but by the grace of God, but by the grace of God. There's a man, his name was John Bradford. He lived from 1510 to 1555. He was an English reformer. And he coined this phrase. One day he's walking along, and through Center Square, they were executing some criminals. And he walks past these poor souls who are being executed for their transgressions. And he looks at them and he says, but by the grace of God, there go I. You ever heard that before? He said that because he didn't look down his nose at them. Ha, look what they got. They deserve it. Look. No, he said, man, if it were not for the grace of God, I'd be hanging right there too. just this humility and this meekness. When we go to people to help them, those who are trapped in a sin, we're going to seek to bear underneath the burden of the fallen, then we need to have a gentleness and a meekness about us. We're seeking to reinstate them. You know, isn't it something, when we go to someone today and we seek to reinstate them, we have kind of this understanding that maybe tomorrow I'm going to have to be reinstated, you know? And that humility helps us as we seek to restore them. Doesn't the gospel help balance us as we seek to bear the burden of the fallen? And all of a sudden, when we think about the standard, we're not thinking about us like, oh, I'm better than they are. No, we just think about the gospel, the goodness of God. That's the standard, and that gives us the boldness to go talk to him, right? It's not about my life. It's about the goodness of God. When we think about Christ's sacrifice, all of a sudden there's hope we can bring to the table. This person's fallen and they're hurting, but we have hope to offer because of Christ's sacrifice. We're reminded by the gospel that we're nothing but forgiven sinners. And so we've got no pride as an ingredient when we're trying to bear into the burdens of the fallen. The gospel gives us balance as we do this. My friends, when confrontation is not done in love, we end up with hardened and embittered brothers and sisters instead of broken and restored ones. And so the call here in the first part of chapter 6 is that we need to bear underneath the weights of the fallen. And we do it with a spirit of gentleness and meekness. But that's not the only burden we need to bear. Look at verses 2 and 3. Because there he's going to say, you need to also bear under the weight of not the fallen, but the feeble. People who are just weak, they're like weighed down. Look at verse number 2. Bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. If anyone thinks he's something when he's nothing, he deceives himself. Now, verses 2 and 3 kind of zooms out. So one burden that we might bear for other people is the burden of them falling in some sort of a transgression. But our burdens are bigger than that. I mean, there's other categories of burdens, right? Not just sin burdens in our lives. I mean, we may have a single parent who's trying to raise their kids, or we may have an unemployed guy who's trying to provide for his family. We may have someone that just got diagnosed with some sort of a disease. Or we may have someone who feels financially crunched right now. I mean, there's all kinds of burdens, right? You know, when I look at a group of people, I often think to myself, what are the invisible burdens that they've brought in with them this morning? Like, I can't see them, but they're the things that keep you awake at night. They're the things that bring tears to your eyes when no one else is around. They're the things you wish you could change, but you feel like you're powerless to do it. I mean, those are the real burdens of our life, right? And these are of no surprise because Scripture talks about these. Remember in 1 Peter chapter 5, casting all your burdens on Him because He cares for you? I mean, we're just like burdened sheep. The whole passage in 1 Peter 5 is about sheep. You know, I mean, here you think about sheep. You're not thinking about burden bearers. I mean, you're not thinking about, well, let's cross the desert, the Sahara, and we'll load up all of our stuff on some pack sheep. Now, I mean, you never think of that. Because all of a sudden you think of this fat, fluffy animal with its legs like flying out like this and all the stuff squishing them. It's because sheep can't carry burdens. And you and I are sheep. And God did not intend us to carry these burdens of life somehow on our own. He says, cast them on me and come next to one another and help. That's what God instructs us to do here. Bear underneath the weight of the field. One of the ways that God sometimes wants our burdens to be borne is by bringing another believer next to us. When you see somebody and they're struggling underneath a weight, don't walk away from them. Rush toward them. Amen. A day and a half ago, Hector and I, we went to Walmart and bought these barbells. And, right? Yeah, we bought these barbells. We're not going to tell you why, but we bought all these barbells. And so I had them sitting at my house. And last night, my four-year-old little girl, she decides she wants to show how she can lift these barbells. She's in bare feet. Just turned 4, bare feet, and she takes both hands, grabs barbells, and it's like, you know, she's holding these things.
And you know what, as a dad, you envision. I mean, you just look at the bare feet, you look at the barbells, you look at her hands. You're like, oh, I'm going to have to go to the hospital. And all of a sudden she starts going, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy. And what do? Well, she seems pretty burdened. Boy, that seems a little too heavy for her. I got to get away. No. I mean, listen, friend, if you love someone who's burdened, what do? You go to them. You rush to them. You help hold the weight. And if we're ever going to be burden bearers, then we need to stand shoulder to shoulder with people who are burdened. And it's kind of like, so what does this look like? Like all of a sudden today, you're sitting here at Gospel Grace Church Assembly, and we finish this service, and you know that there are people who are hurting. So you rush out because you got to beat the Methodist to Chili's? I mean, no. You stop and you help that person who's hurting. You know somebody's in financial trouble here this morning. I mean, they're just struggling. So what do? Do you rush? No. You may need to help. You know someone got some bad news this week. Then maybe you don't leave here this morning. Maybe you go to a corner and you just pray with that person. You just show them some love. Or you come in here and everyone has someone to sit next to except this one person, and they're like all alone, and you see them alone often. You're like, I wonder if that person is hurting and they're lonely. And all of a sudden you just love that person because that's what it means to bear burdens. You know. So if we could just bury our conceit and our selfishness and our all this me, if we could just bury that stuff, then all of a sudden we'd be free to start bearing some of the burdens of people around us. People who are fallen, people who are feeble. The fact of the matter is we all have burdens. Job had trials. Paul had cares. Jesus suffered. We all have burdens. And we're supposed to be mutually dependent. Do you know that some of the imagery of the church is that we're a body? And that means that the finger is dependent on the hand, which is dependent on the arm, which is dependent on the shoulder. I mean, we're supposed to be engaged, connected to one another. And when one hurts, we all hurt. In 1 Corinthians 12, Paul wrote this. He said, let there be no division in the body, but that the members may have the same care for one another. If one member suffers, we all suffer together. If one member is honored, we all rejoice together. That's how connected Gospel Grace Church is supposed to be. If there's someone who's suffering, we rush to that person and we uphold that burden with them instead of running away from them. We suffer together. We rejoice together. I think sometimes the breakdown in mutuality happens when we're too proud to ask for help, or we're too proud to admit weakness, or we don't want anyone to know we have a need. And then you end up with people who suffer alone because they're just too proud. Listen, my friend, if that's you, you're hurting, and you need someone to help bear that burden, then you have to be willing to get honest. God resists the proud. But what does he do for those who are humble? He just pours out grace. And that may be through a brother or a sister coming and helping to bear your load. All of this, we get this reminder. In verse number 2, notice, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. We get this reminder that if we're willing to bear underneath the weights of the feeble, then we are actually doing what Jesus commanded us to do. We're fulfilling the law of Christ. Notice the singular. Not fulfilling the laws of Christ. We're fulfilling the law of Christ. You see, in the Old Testament, there were 613 laws. But when it came to Jesus, he said, a new commandment give I unto you, that you love one another. Like, if we could just summarize it all, it would just be, you need to love each other. That's what Jesus would say if he were here this morning. What that means is bearing under the burdens of the fallen, bearing under the burdens of the feeble. You know, at Gospel Grace Church, in our church covenant, we've actually committed to do that. If you're a member of Gospel Grace Church, then you covenanted this. Listen, this is in our church covenant. We will seek to promote the affectionate care and watchfulness over each other. We will faithfully admonish and entreat one another as occasion requires. We will rejoice at each other's happiness. We will endeavor with tenderness and sympathy to bear each other's burdens and sorrows. If you're a member of Gospel Grace Church, that's what you committed to do, to bear underneath the burdens of the fallen, the burdens of the feeble. Now, we live lives that are often challenged in this way because we want to live individualistic lives. My concerns are my concerns. My problems are my problems. My life is my life.
Well, that may be how you feel because you're an American, but that can't be how you feel if you're a Christian. Because Christians are not called to individuality. Christians are called to community. And that's why we bear each other's burdens. Bear underneath the burdens of the fallen. Bear underneath the burdens of the feeble. The last thing that this passage says as we close is you need to bear underneath the weight or the burden of final judgment. You say, where does that? Well, look at verses 4 and 5. Verses 4 and 5. But let each one test his own work, and then his reason to boast will be in himself alone and not in his neighbor, for each will have to bear his own load. As you read that, you're kind of like, well, didn't he just say we're supposed to bear each other's burdens, and now he's saying bear your own? Well, the words are different here. The word for burden is different than the word for load. A burden is a weight that you can't carry. I mean, it's something that you're going to collapse under. We're supposed to bear each other's burdens. We're supposed to shoulder some of that weight. But a load is different. A load is something, this word was used to refer to a ship's cargo, so what it could hold, or it was supposed to refer to a soldier's knapsack, what was actually issued to him. This has been issued to you. You keep track of this. This is yours. A soldier's knapsack or a pilgrim's backpack, what's needed for his trek. And so I want you to think for a second, what is God doing here? He's saying, well, listen, there have been some things that have been issued to you by God. And one day you will have to give an account for that. It's kind of like if the Air Force issues me my A bag and I've got all these different supplies in it, one day there's going to be accounting for that. I have to account for what's been issued to me. And he's saying here, actually, God looks at each one of our lives and he issues us certain things. So God has issued you certain gifts. God has issued you certain talents. God has issued you certain events. God has issued you certain trials. So how have you responded to what you've been issued? That's what he says. So bear this with a view towards final judgment. I think there's some passages of scripture that could help us with this. You know, you think about 2 Corinthians 5:10. My friends, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil. Or Romans 14:11, for we must all stand before the judgment seat of God. For it is written, as I live, says the Lord, every knee will bow, every tongue shall confess. So then each of us will give account of himself to God. And so the picture here is this. In community, we bear each other's burdens. But in reality, we also have our own things that have been issued to us by God. And when it gets to judgment day, we're not going to be able to stand there. God says, I issued this to you. What have you done? And you say, well, nobody came over here to help me. Listen, my friend, no one's going to be standing around you. It's you. What did you do? Well, I know you gave me this, God, but I just decided not to invest it. And there were no one else to encourage me to invest it. No, my friend. It's just you. Learn to bear your own load. That's what he's saying here. And so when we start thinking the right way, and this kind of circles us all the way back to the beginning, when we start thinking the right way, when we start walking in step with the Spirit, then all of a sudden we take all the self-focus, all the conceit, provoking one another, envying one another. We take all of the me and we bury it. And then we take all of the others and we start burying it with a view towards final judgment that one day I'll give an account. Let's pray together.